is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Karen Swallow Pryor. Now, if you haven't heard of Karen Swallow Pryor before, you need to know about her and her work. She's doing some incredible things. I brought her on this episode to talk about her recently released book called On Reading Well. And it's a book that sort of tackles classic literature and really makes a case for why Christians should be reading the classics. And like, this is just a really important topic, because we don't just talk about like classic literature in this episode. We talk about how that leads into our interpretations of things like the Bible, how literature changes us and can change, you know, how we even relate to other people. And it's a really important topic to talk about. So many times our reading diet just becomes informational and even like quick reads, like on our phone or whatever, as opposed to sort of sitting with a really good book, a piece of classic literature, and really being transformed by it. I think it's a really important thing. It's something that I'm really trying to do in my own life, and just seeing a need for my own sense of creativity, but just even willingness to engage on a different level emotionally and all of those things. So you're going to get a lot out of this episode. It's awesome. Before we get to it, I just want to remind you to make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle, and on Twitter at Curry Blanford, just to stay up to date with all the things we got going on and all the great guests that are coming on the show. So do all that for me and enjoy hearing from Karen. All right. Well, Dr. Pryor, thanks so much for making some time for me and coming on the show. It is good to hang out with you a little bit. Excited to chat.
I'm excited to be here. I love this topic of work and hustle.
Perfect. I love it. I love somebody who's on board with the work topic. So let's get started by just kind of maybe having you introduce yourself a little bit to everybody.
Well, I am currently research professor of English and Christianity and Culture at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, and that follows 21 years as an English professor at Liberty University, where I came immediately upon finishing my PhD in English. And that, I'm kind of going backwards, I guess, and that follows just a life of loving and reading books from when I was a little girl, and just pursuing that and not knowing where it would lead. And in fact, I actually, when I was young, I said that there were two things that I would never want to be, and that was a nurse and a teacher. I would not want to be a nurse. But here I am. I accidentally discovered that I was created to teach, and that's what animates and drives everything I do, from my writing to my tweeting, and even sometimes, unfortunately, in my personal relationships. You know, I just like to teach everybody, but sure. I have to hold back on that. So
I get that. I very much get that. And I liked going backwards. I feel like a nice change of pace is like really helpful for me. So
okay.
That's awesome. Yeah. Okay. I love story, as I know you do. So can we just sort of walk down your story? Like, what led you even, I mean, I know you love books and stuff, but what led you even into higher education for, you know, literature and English and all of that stuff?
Yeah. So yes, I did. I grew up always reading, loving reading, and doing well in school. I loved school. I especially loved English, but I never even knew like that. Well, I said I didn't want to be a teacher, so that was part of it, but I never even knew that an academic career was an option, or I didn't know what that was. I didn't have that sort of in my imagination. But at some point, when I was pretty small, I think my parents had were hosts to like some college students who were coming and singing in church or something like that. And I think I just got infatuated with these college girls, like they were college girls. And when I was about seven, I just decided I couldn't wait to go to college. And I don't think I even knew what that was, but I wanted to go to college. I just thought I would be all kinds of things. I thought I'd be a veterinarian. I thought I'd be a psychiatrist. And then I just ended up choosing social work, because ironically, I thought that that I didn't want to go to college for and grad school for so many years to become a psychiatrist. So I thought, well, I can just help people by going to college for 5 years instead of with a and get an MSW. So I chose my school based on its program for getting an MSW, which is a social work master's. And lo and behold, by the, you know, my first semester of statistics, I and learning what social work really is, I had no desire to do that. But in the meantime, I was falling in love with a more disciplined and rigorous study of English in my classes at college than I had all those years in high school. Even though I loved English, it was something that was easy, not something that I understood you could pursue, you know, in a rigorous way. So I switched my major to English, still thinking I didn't want to be a teacher, did an internship at a marketing agency and decided I hated that. And because I didn't know what else to do, I applied to a PhD program and I got in. And that's where I discovered that I love to teach.
Yeah, that's cool. I love that. I love just hearing how like the twists and turns of people's stories, especially as it relates to your vocation, because vocation just has this like, I mean, it is who you are in a lot of ways, right? I mean, like even you talking about how you loved English and you didn't even sort of put together or literature that you didn't even put together that could be a career.
Right.
You know, that, I mean, that's a pretty good sign that you're doing something right. Right.
And that's why my advice to college students in particular, if they are already in college and they're going to a 4-year college and they want to know what to major in, I tell them to just major in the thing that they love. Because a 4-year degree, you know, is basically a 4-year degree. And that if by pursuing, if you're in that place already where you are privileged enough to be in college, then you should take the freedom that you have to pursue the thing that you love. And you can do other things on the side that are more practical. I mean, that's what I did. I took a practical minor in public relations, and that's how I discovered I hated it. But I ended up using it because I do a lot of kind of public relations in my work, right?
Sure.
Advocating and promoting the things I believe in.
Yeah. I mean, even your Twitter is a great example of a, you know, a need for public relations, right? Like that's how you're so active on there. And yeah, I love that. That's great, great advice. So I know you recently sort of made a career change, not change in your career, but you know, a place that you're working. And I was just curious as to, okay, so you're at Liberty for 20 plus years. Is that right?
21.
And I don't know much about that tenure, except what I've heard on like sort of the gangster capitalism podcast, you know, I know it's tumultuous, right?
Right.
And I know you're now in at a seminary. And I guess my question is, why have you chosen? Thank you. Why have you chosen to stick with Christian higher education as opposed to moving on to, you know, a more secular institution?
Yeah, that's a great question. Of course, my education was entirely secular. I mean, I went to public schools my whole life, and I did go to a private liberal arts college, but it wasn't a Christian one, and then to a state university. And I didn't really encounter Christian education of any kind until I was in my PhD program. Actually, part of what I did while I was in that program on the side is, you know, many people are struggling to get through. I had another job. I had a job, and that was I got hired to teach English at a Christian high school, and then I got asked to be its principal. So I was a Christian school administrator for several years before I finished my PhD. And so I became immersed in the world of Christian education. And so when I went out on the job market, upon finishing my PhD, I was before the Lord completely open-handed and saying, if you want me to go to a secular institution, which is really where I kind of felt more at home. I grew up and went to school in the liberal Northeast, so I was used to being very much a minority as a Christian. So I thought I would end up at a secular school and sort of be a Christian there. But I also believed in Christian education and wanted to disciple Christian young people. And so I was really open before the Lord. And I immediately got the job at Liberty, which was really a big deal, because when I finished my PhD, I mean, the job market is bad now, but it was bad then. Most weren't getting full-time jobs at that time anywhere. And so, but I, you know, Liberty it just went so quickly. I got the job there, and I really do in that time there, it was confirmed in me that I am really more of a discipler than an evangelist. And I really do feel called to helping Christians, especially, you know, we're really of any age, but in particular college age Christians, think and form and grow for the sake of the church. Because we, you know, the church is in a bad place right now, and we need to disciple people better.
Yeah, amen to that. So much to sort of unpack there. Do you feel like, and a lot of, you know, what you're talking about is just like giving Christians really like a love for literature and like classical literature. Do you feel like the, I don't know, like there's more of an uphill battle in where you've chosen to, you know, work than there would be at different institutions?
Yes, but I've always seen it as more of a need. So sure. Yes, it is an uphill battle. But even the battle has changed, because when I first started teaching in, well, at Liberty 21 years ago, but even in Christian secondary education longer ago than that, there was just kind of this resistance to worldly reading. Even, you know, Harry Potter was verboten, and so there was kind of a struggle to get Christians to be open to reading all kinds of literature. And now I would say the struggle is everyone's reading everything, but we need to be more discerning, and we need to have better standards of taste and judgment, even as we read many things, but just to simply know that there is more than Harry Potter out there, and there is more than Tolkien. I see it as a great need, but I also see it as, I mean, to be completely honest, when I was growing up as a little girl reading books and more in love with stories that I read than the church and Sunday school, I never ever dreamed that God would use my love of literature for the church to disciple people and to grow them and to help them, equip them, and to increase their, you know, critical thinking and discernment skills. I never dreamed that would be the case. And it's amazing to me.
Yeah, I think that's cool. I think it's for me specifically, even, it's like really heartening. My daughter is probably how you were when you were young. Like literally I have to like make her stop reading, you know, it's like a problem. And so, you know, just, I think even like seeing somebody who's been down that road and who has used those skills and that love for something, you know, in this Christian world in a way that you wouldn't think, I think is like really encouraging, you know? So I think that's cool. I do. But I guess in reading your book, we're talking about your book on reading well, which I've been reading and really enjoying a lot. I think you did a really great job with it, but I guess I'm sort of kind of taking a trip through my own journey of like literature and whatnot. And so, you know, I did college, I did grad school in Christian, you know, Bible theology stuff. Right. And like, so that was never a part of my education, right? It was always like theological works, you know, interpretation, all that stuff. But even like looking back into high school, I feel like I can remember times in high school where like I tried to interpret some piece of literature, some like poem that the teacher wanted me to, and was told like, basically that is a, you know, that is like the wrong interpretation, or not even an interpretation. And I feel like those moments caused me to really like doubt whether I even should be reading those sorts of works, or have you seen that just in sort of teaching and how that sort of affects the way people read?
Absolutely. I see it a lot, especially when I'm teaching, you know, freshmen or sophomores in introductory level courses where we have a real weakness in reading well, which is why I wrote the book. And that, you know, there's another book to be written that perhaps I will someday, that's even just more fundamental and more basic. And I don't even mean it that in an insulting way. But for example, you talked about poetry. We have, you know, a generation or two or three of students who have been taught to look for like hidden meanings in poems and the deeper meaning. And you know, there are deeper meanings to poems, but the deeper meanings are found in the literal words.
Sure.
So to just look closely at what the word, what words that have been selected and chosen and arranged in a very deliberate way, and what those words say, and then therefore, you know, kind of what the deeper meaning in that is. And so, yes, you know, the beauty of language and literature is that that it does need to be interpreted, right? Yeah. It's an interpretive activity, but there are just good interpretations and bad ones, and ones that are in between, and they are all have to be rooted. The answer to an interpretation is rooted in the words themselves, in the text, which I think is exciting for a Christian because we are people of a text yeah. as well. And so yeah. we need to employ those same skills that we use in reading the Bible. We can't just say, this is what it means to me. Oh, I guess we can. Sorry, we do that a lot. We say, means to me, right? And of course, there's application, but that application, again, has to be rooted in what the words actually say.
Yeah, again, like the scriptures, which is sort of, yeah, right. There's a whole interpretation and application issue. I actually was thinking, we're here. Let's just get into that a little bit because, you know, we've brought it up, you know, at this point. So I love exegesis, right? Like interpretation. That's what my degrees are in. And like, I don't know. Do you feel like there is a major dearth of love of, let me start over real quick. I'm going to say something that might be a little offensive, but I wonder if evangelicals just haven't gotten a little too obsessed with Paul and just read like only Paul in the New Testament and like have forgotten how the narratives of scripture actually can teach us a lot of things, maybe even different things than what Paul can teach. Right. And so when we just focus on those epistles, we lose out on so much of the like bulk of the entirety of this Bible, which is narrative. Yes.
No, I think that's a great insight. And I would not blame it so much on Paul or our love of Paul.
Sure,
I would say it's really more an outgrowth of the sort of systematic theology that comes from modernity. You know, modernity loves its categories and its binaries and its structures and systems. I like those things too, but there's more than that. There is the narrative. There is the mystery. And it's not either or, it's both and.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And we're just, I feel like a lot of times we're just not good readers, like especially in those narrative. And a lot of, I don't think people give the Old Testament authors especially enough credit for the way that they are doing, the way that they are writing and connecting ideas and all of that stuff. So I don't know. With our current political, I'll wade into our current political, you know, sphere. Like, I think a lot of where we're at politically as evangelicals could be like taken care of if we all just read like 1 Samuel, like really carefully and understood what they were saying about like, you know, the people desiring a king, getting Saul, you know, like it feels very reminiscent of how we're interacting with the world. And like, that's a very simple narrative that like is very easy to interpret, I think.
You know, no, you're absolutely right. And that inability to sort of interpret and read is seen in so many contexts. I mean, that's just one context. But this is a metaphor that I've used before. In some ways, it's almost like we are in another dark age. And it's not because we have too little information. It's because we have too much. So there's so much around us that we can just sort of pick and choose not only what we read, but, you know, interpretations of, you know, that are of things. So we're choosing not only our primary sources, but our secondary and third level sources and the interpretations. And we can just pick and choose in a kind of pastiche, which is which is different from a system. So, you know, I kind of dismissed systems and systematic theology and categories a few minutes ago, but they do have a place because what we have now is, again, just this pastiche and collage, and we pick and choose, and that's not good either.
Huh. That's really interesting. I'd never even thought about that. Like, you would think that more information would like lead us away from dark ages, right? Like that's sort of, what you kind of associate with those words, right? Dark ages is like ignorance and like, you know, and so it's not an, or it's an ignorance born out of
too
an
much.
Overload.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
that feels a lot harder to overcome than just ignorance from not knowing.
I agree. Okay. I agree. I think it is a bigger problem.
Hmm.
Yeah. Wow.
So, would your solution to some of that be like what you're talking about in your book on reading well, like reading the classics?
I love the classics and I want people to read them. But even those who don't, you know, who feel intimidated by the classics, of course, my book is for them and is to help them. But even just to read simpler things better, to read everything, to focus on reading. Another part of why we don't read well is because we read everything for information. We read it as fast as we can rather than just really focusing on what is being said. This is something that I've sort of done in my own circles is challenge people gently when they post something or share something or say something that I know is wildly off, is to just kind of look at it again. Like, what is the thesis of this, or where does it say that? We read so carelessly so often, and then just sort of spin something out of, you know, into something that it's not. And it's the fast paced world we live in. It's the digital age. You know, Twitter is a contextless form. And so we're fighting against a lot of things that work against good, careful reading and understanding. But really, reading is also a metaphor. So all of these things that we're talking about with reading words on a page also apply to reading people and reading situations and reading relationships. Like, we have to read carefully and not carelessly. And I think that's at the heart of so much that we're struggling with today.
Can you unpack like what you mean by sort of reading people and situations?
Yeah, sure. Well, so just think of reading as a synonym for interpretation. So, right. So, so when we read words on a page, if it's just information, which is very rare that it's just, I mean, even a newspaper article has interpretation, right?
Yeah,
so,
right.
So we need to read between the lines in a newspaper article, but we still have to read on the lines.
Yeah.
And even when we're talking to a person in a relationship, I mean, how many times do we get into arguments over what someone said or how they said it, right? And it's both things. Well, I didn't say that. Well, you said this. And we're working, trying to figure out, well, what was really meant? And did I hear what was really meant? Because there's so much room, even in a simple disagreement, for misunderstanding. And so this act of interpretation is the essence of what we are doing. We do as people of the word, as Christians, is the essence of what we do as human beings in relationship to other human beings. We are interpretive creatures, and yet we have really just not stewarded this gift of interpretation that we have as part of being made in God's image, and we're just not good interpreters.
Yeah. And a lot of that, would you say that has to do with just the way our society functions and how fast it is and like kind of keeping pace? Is that
one of
the main issues?
There are lots of ways that we can describe what's happened. I mean, if we want to do a deep sort of philosophical dive, we can talk about, you know, Charles Taylor's A Secular Age, where he talks about, you know, thinness and thickness, and our lives in the modern secular age are thin in the sense that there's just a lot of flatness and quickness and superficiality in what we read, in you know, our fast-paced life. Even just, you know, we eat food and we don't know where it comes from. We have nothing to do really with the process of that. So even even the things that we do to stay alive have sort of a thinness to them because of just the nature of modern life. And it's not our fault. And there are many gifts of modernity. I'm so glad for modern medicine and technology, but we have to be mindful of what we've given up as well and try to recover that.
Yeah. I was just talking about this. I've been doing a series on the book of Revelation and sort of how we can use it, you know, practically talking about the harlot of Babylon, but just how our entire system is dehumanizing us from like the way we consume goods to, like you said, our food source, like everything we do is becoming more and more dehumanized. Right. And I think a lot of that has to play. We don't, we don't think about that in our like industrial society, like we're post-industrial revolution where, you know, our lives like completely changed, and yet we have no context for what life was like before any of that. Right.
Right.
Yeah. That's good stuff. These feel like really big problems, and they feel like really hard to even think about. Do you find that to be true as well?
I do, but I think being kind of a student of history, at least through the area of literature, I'm reminded often of how when print culture was on the rise, when much material, whether in pamphlet or book form, was being printed and more people could read it, there was a lot of anxiety. That changed the world. I often recommend that people read Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death, because he really gives, it's a very, you know, reader-friendly approach to some really deep history and philosophy about the forms of media and what happened in the 17th and 18th century when we became a print culture, and what's happening now, even though this book was written 40 years ago or 50 years ago, what's happening now in sort of a technological entertainment age. So it's a change, but it is similar to one that we saw before, but I still think it's, you know, a 300 or 400 or 500 year moment, and we're the ones kind of living through it. So it does, I think, as being the ones who are living through this huge change, it does feel big, because I think it is big.
It's amazing how history comes back to play. I mean, it's almost like we should know stuff about like stuff that happened before. It's just bizarre.
I know. Go figure.
Right. Okay. So as you've been talking, I've been thinking a lot about the book by Mortimer J. Adler, I think, on how to read a book.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I just like that book sort of changed my life in a lot of ways, because I realized I didn't know how to read, you know, as a senior in college. Right. And so, a lot of what you're talking about is even that, like, how, like, there are books that you're reading just informationally, right? And there are books you're reading for, like, subtext or, like, interpreting it, you know? So how do we kind of think about maybe some, like, even how to read a book as a as a low level?
Yeah, Adler is great, and his approach is more sort of about the practical tips about reading more slowly and more interactively and critically, and that's really important. I mean, I think for me, a lot of this works backwards, because I spent so much time reading like poetry and literature, and so learning how to read some of the hardest words well, then kind of go, if I'm reading a newspaper article or a tweet, you know, I bring those, that same skill set to reading something that's a little bit simpler, but still trying to really understand what's being said. And so, again, I think even for a Christian, just to understand, most Christians know how we're supposed to read the Bible, whether we do it or not. You know, we know we're supposed to read it, you know, attentively and within context and understand it. Really, those are the same skills that we need to use when we're reading, you know, Jane Austen. Or you know, any lit or a poem. And then, like any muscle, like reading is a skill, it's a very basic skill, but it's one that you get better at the more you do it. And so when you practice it, and especially when you do that intentionally, I mean, if I, you know, just, you know, even like a sports metaphor, when, or, you know, someone who's, I mean, we can exercise our muscles in a lot of different ways. Some people are just doing it because they're doing manual labor. Some people are doing it because they're, you know, at the gym or playing in a sport, and that's exercising them. But when you do that, you get better after time, and reading is the same way. And I'll say, even not only the skill of reading, but even the attention span that for most of us is diminishing, including me, if we practice extending our attention span and deepening it, and we practice reading closely and attentively, we get better at it, but it still takes practice.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. My attention span's even lower from the last like 18 months of whatever we've been living through.
You know, so we're all in that boat, I think.
That's why I can talk to people. I can have conversations. This is like very pleasant, but like sitting down to read can feel like sort of a chore, I think, these days. So, yeah. I'm learning to exercise these muscles and at the same time, like, you know, having to have grace with myself, I guess.
Right. Exactly.
So, yeah.
I mean, I stopped going to the gym during the pandemic. And so now I'm back and I can, my muscles lost a lot during those 18 months. So, you know, the same is true of any other skill.
Man, getting back into it is for sure the hardest part. Those like first few weeks of, you know, exercising your muscles are the worst part. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it's probably similar with, you know, getting back into reading, right? That's good. Okay, so let's talk then classic literature and why, I guess. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, when I use the term classic literature, I use that term broadly. I mean, we do have modern classics. And so I think it's actually more helpful to talk about the category of literary writing, whether it's literary fiction or poetry or drama, because what literary writing does that's different from just sort of informational writing or even, you know, even novels that we read that might just be, you know, mysteries or suspense or, you know, action. Literary writing uses words in an artistic way that goes beyond just giving information. I mean, literary writing uses words that change it. It doesn't just tell us a story. Stories are great, and I love stories, but it uses language in such a way that it can actually alter the way we think about our own world, because we are creatures of language. We use words to process our experiences and to describe our experiences even internally. And so literary writing enriches and enlarges that treasure trove that we have of words through which we can understand our own experience. And that's why when we, you know, I think a good way of a test between just any old book that's for entertainment or a literary work is that a literary work is just as, if not more, rewarding when we reread it, because the words keep revealing things to us that are weren't just on the surface of the plot and character. Whereas an you know, I do listen to like Stephen King when I'm running on Audible, right? And I love Stephen King. I think he's actually a great writer. But most of his work, well, he's kind of in between. There are other suspense novels I might listen to that I'm not going to listen to again,
right?
Because there's no point. But with literary works, over and over, there are things that are revealed about ourselves and our world because of the way that the language is used. In the same way that a great artist, a painter or sculptor, create something that we want to keep looking at again and again.
Yeah, that's interesting. It was occurring to me as I was like, I don't know, reading through your book. And I really love because you're taking one of the virtues, right, that we can pull out of these books and talking about them like through literature, which I found like super helpful. But it's amazing to me that somebody can think that way. And like, what depth do you have to have in order to sort of weave that virtue into a story as an author? Does that, I don't even know if I'm asking a question, but just maybe like making an observation. It just seems amazing to me.
Well, I just want to kind of, alter what you said, because I don't make a claim that these authors were trying to do this and they were trying to weave these virtues. What I'm saying is that because these are great works, we can interpret them as readers in such a way that we find them there. Now, they are there. I'm not violating the text.
Sure.
But all good stories are about the human condition. And the human condition is always going to include vices and virtues and tragedy and comedy and all of these things that encompass what it means to be human. And so a good reader is going to see what's already in the text. And that's what I tried to do in the book, is bring out. And most of these works aren't even, they're not about any of these things. I mean, maybe The Great Gatsby really is a lot about temperance. But a lot of it was just me seeing one small slice of what's in the text, as opposed to saying, oh, this is exactly what the author was trying to do. Yeah,
for sure. I guess, and more of it's just how to weave a story around those sorts of things. Not that you're intentionally doing it, but just like, my brain doesn't function in that way, I guess is what I'm saying, right? Like it's always incredible to me how these people can tell stories in these ways, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I'm a critic, not a writer. I mean, you know, not a writer of fiction. I just like to read them. I don't know that I have it in me to create something like that.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. What are some of the, like, I don't know, as you think about like some of these great works of literature, what do you think are some of the ones that like are like go-tos? Like if somebody was wanting to really like step into this world, like where would you send somebody?
Well, there are lots of works that I would send them to, and I can name some, but I do, you know, want to take this opportunity to do my, you know, requisite self-promotion and say that I have, you know, edited a series of classics that are, you know, that are books that include the work, but also have my introductions that really help the reader, without giving any spoilers to the plot, enter the text and know what that story is doing, what to look for, and then I have discussion questions. So the four volumes that are already out are Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility, Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Sure. So yeah. these are just, I chose these classics for a variety of different reasons. You know, some of which has to do with how many of those editions are already out there. So if I were recommending Jane Austen for a first timer, I would actually recommend Pride and Prejudice. It's famous for a reason. And the one thing people need to know about Jane Austen if they don't, is that she's a satirist and she's hilarious. These are not romances. There are love stories, but she's actually satirizing humankind. So Jane Austen is a great place to start. Just a couple of years ago, for the first time, I read John Steinbeck's East of Eden, and I was blown away. That book is fantastic, and it's a retelling of so many of the great stories of the Old Testament woven into the lives of these, you know, of these early 20th century Americans in ways that are just kind of take you off guard and are so powerful and rich. So I think that's a great book.
Yeah, that's cool. I'll make sure all that's in the show notes so people can easily access all those. And yeah, I think that work is really helpful because I mean, I'll be honest, like it's just really intimidating coming to some of these books and like the, you know, seeing the size of them sometimes and being like, you know, I'm not sure what I'm going to, you know, jump into here. When I was first convicted about really like not having read enough fiction in my life and stuff, I picked up Gilead for the first time and like, man, I struggled just because I didn't have muscles at all.
Right,
it was like benching like, you know, 400 pounds or something. You know, it was like, it just, I didn't have the wherewithal for something like that. So it's nice to have somewhere to go to like, just even dip a toe in, I guess, to some of these things. So that's good. Can I ask, why focus as you do on Victorian literature as opposed to like other places you could go?
You mean personally or
personally,
for other people?
Yeah.
I mean, I just, you know, when you're in a PhD program, you really narrow your area of specialty. And my area was the 18th century, which is before the Victorian period, and the origins of the novel. But since then, because it was also just the novel, which is really, you know, was developed in the 18th and 19th centuries, that's where I landed. 18th century novels are really fun and interesting, but it's the Victorian novel that really perfected the art, so they're actually more enjoyable to read. 18th century novels are a little rough, so they're not as user friendly, but the Victorian novel is just, I just think, is wonderful. And I my dissertation is actually on kind of brings all of my passions together, because it was on Hannah More, who was an evangelical Anglican, an abolitionist and a poet. And she wrote one novel that was a huge bestseller in her time. It's not even readable today because our tastes have changed so much. But she was someone who was an activist, a reformer, a devout Christian, and she loved literature. And she used her gift of writing to try to help people to disciple people and to help them to become more moral and to reform all of society. So she wasn't the greatest literary artist, because I don't think you can do both of those things. You can't be sort of didactic and try to change people, but she still, she wrote a novel that really did influence people at the time.
Was it that you saw like something of yourself in, you know, the way she operated?
I think that I did. I mean, I discovered her very accidentally. I was planning on writing about an earlier novelist, and I was researching him when I discovered that she was part of a circle of women who would read his early manuscripts and give him feedback. And I had never heard of her, and I said, I want to learn more about this woman. And the more that I learned about her, the more I realized she really is a role model, not just for me personally, but for, I think, for Christians today, because she was so effective and influential in her time by kind of bringing together all these different aspects of society.
Yeah, that's cool. I think that's cool to see that play out in who you are, you know, and that the way that your vocation and your work plays out in, yeah,
right,
who you are. I think that's important stuff. Well, Karen, what are the best places to sort of find you, you know, follow you, all those things?
Yeah. So I'm most active probably on Twitter, KSPRIOR. If you just want basic information, some of my writings and my books are on my website, KarenSwallowPryor.com. And I am on Instagram, is kind of my safe space. I just like to post pictures, although sometimes I do post controversial things there, I guess. But I'm also on Instagram at Karen Swallow Pryor.
Yeah. I find Instagram much easier for me because I can just like post pretty pictures of my family and like it's okay. And then Twitter, I like say one thing and have 15 people yelling at me about it. So yeah. That's great. I love that. Are you okay if we jump into the final two questions as we wrap up here?
Yeah.
Okay. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
I think the strange, I don't know how strange it is, but I had two jobs during college and then grad school cleaning horse stalls. Yeah.
That's fun. Yeah.
I love horses and I loved working on a horse farm. I worked on two different horse farms and I did different things, but I started out as a stall cleaner, became an assistant trainer, and then took another job as a stall cleaner.
I'm a Texan originally, so I've been around a lot of horses in my day. So, so my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
I think it's the same advice about being, you know, being a good person, a good Christian, a good human being is, do good work, be faithful, be humble, let your character and your work ethic show. It's not so much talking about Jesus as it is modeling him in whatever we're doing, whether it's cleaning stalls, or, you know, preaching the word.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. That's awesome. Karen, thanks so much again for making time for me and for the work pushing us all into, you know, the classics. I love it.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Karen, talking about interpretation, which is just something so near and dear to my heart. And talking about the classic literature. I just encourage you to go check out all of these works we talked about. She gave so much good stuff. I tried to link as much of that as I could in the show notes. That's easily accessible for you there. But go read a book. You know, I think that's a great advice for all of us. It changes us. And I think it does makes us better interpreters, but also just better people. So, go read a book. I would be super helpful if you'd scroll to the bottom of your iTunes app. You can leave a rating and review for me there. Just helps people find out about a Theology of Hustle and realize that other people are listening and enjoying. So I greatly appreciate you doing that. And until next time, get out there and hustle.